Court will proceed to the third case, Shannon versus Cullinan. Oh no, I'm mistaken, excuse me. Third case is Mulgrew versus Bodenstein. Kirkman.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a tough case because there's a lot at stake for Mr. Mulgrew, as I've outlined in my brief. The case is about the conversion of a Chapter 11 operating case to a Chapter 7 liquidation under 11.
Before we get much further, I have a question about appellate jurisdiction.
Okay.
Why is a conversion appealable as a final decision? Bankruptcy is still ongoing. No plan of reorganization or liquidation has been approved. Everything seems to be still underway. How is this an appealable order?
Did the court say that reorganization is ongoing?
Or liquidation or anything else. The bankruptcy proceeding is still ongoing.
I mean, at this point in time, the debtor has essentially lost all of its rights under the Chapter 11 case. And I believe that we cited the cases in our brief that, to the effect of when you have...
You cited in your brief a case in which a district judge held that the bankruptcy judge's order was reviewable by a district court. But under 28 U.S.C. 158A, district judges can review interlocutory orders of bankruptcy judges. Our jurisdiction depends on Section 158D, and we can review only a subset of those orders, that is, the final decision. And so my question is, why is this a final decision when the bankruptcy is ongoing?
Your Honor, there is nothing more that can happen in the reorganization. As between the parties, as between this debtor, there is nothing more that this debtor can do. His hands are tied. He's done.
What do you mean he's done? Has the district court, has the bankruptcy court entered the final order of liquidation? Has it ordered the property sold?
The court has authorized the sale. The sale has not been completed. When the sale is completed, this appeal would be moot.
I understand the principle we've actually held that an actual order of sale, a foreclosure order, putting it up for auction, is independently appealable. But I don't think we have held, and so far as I can tell, no court of appeals has ever held, that a conversion order is appealable.
With all due respect, I mean, you had cited this issue in the Woodbrook case. I mean, you haven't decided this issue because it wasn't raised. This court has addressed the conversion of a Chapter 11 case. I mean, it wasn't an issue in the Woodbrook case when you denied when the appellant appealed the conversion of the case, and in that case you upheld the conversion. In that case has been around for quite some time. If you want to raise that issue specifically about jurisdiction at this point,
Which case are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of Woodbrook, which is what my...
In my Woodbrook associate?
I believe so, Your Honor. Matter of Woodbrook Associates, 19 F3D 312, 1994 case. I mean, I think you specifically, you didn't get hung up on a jurisdictional issue, you went right into the merits. But as far as jurisdiction goes, I believe that an order is final when there is really nothing left between the parties to decide. And as to this debtor, there is nothing left for this debtor, his right to be decided. He is out of the picture once that conversion took place. Things are out of his hands. And in this case, there's not going to be any assets that are going to flow through to this Chapter 11 debtor or the debtor.
So you predict.
Your Honor, I think the published studies almost universally hold that it's very unlikely.
We're interested in likelihoods. That's one reason for insisting on final decisions. We see what actually happens. Let me put it a different way. Are you representing that there's no possibility of any other appeal in this case? That no matter what the bankruptcy judge does, specifying the distribution, how the sale is to occur, what interest will be sold, who will be the residual beneficiaries, there'll be no more appeals?
Of course not. There certainly could be appeals.
Isn't that the usual definition of a final judgment? The final judgment is the terminating order, and we then get one appeal wrapping up the case.
But you get one appeal wrapping up the, not the case, the dispute between the parties. This court will hear appeals if we have an objection to a claim, that claim is objected to, and there's a resolution of that objection. I believe that can be appealed.
No. That's fully established.
In this case, there is nothing more for Mr. Malmgren in this case. He is out of the case. There is no realistic possibility that he is going to see a dime. Unsecured creditors aren't going to see a dime. So if he doesn't have a right to appeal, that means that and I think virtually every case that is converted, it can never go beyond the district court.
The appeal in Woodbrook, which I have now looked up and have read on screen, is from the approval and confirmation of a plan of reorganization. It was not an appeal from a conversion from one section to another.
Then I apologize. My notes indicate
Well, why don't we proceed? We'll obviously have to address this issue.
Okay. This court found, when I argued before, this court, excuse me, the bankruptcy court found that when we had the hearing on conversion, that there was a possibility that a plan could be confirmed in the case. That was because of, I had argued to the court that we could, there was a combination of selling assets, financing, and continued operations. I then also told the court what I thought was a realistic goal to go toward a plan, also timetable. What the court did, though, was it did, when a case moves toward a plan, we're dealing with multiple parties. We may be dealing with 10 parties, all on the other side of the table, all wanting the same thing from the debtor, as much money as they can get. And what a debtor's counsel has to do is bring all those people together. And in this case, in one of the first hearings I had before the judge in February 14th, he was saying, how can you confirm a plan in this case if I, the debtor, do not have the approval and backing of the secured parties? And I said to the judge, you're wrong. The secured parties are the easiest people to cram down on. It's the unsecured parties, as the Supreme Court held in North of South, that I can't generally cram down. But under 1129B, I can cram down on a secured party relatively easily. And as the court, I think, misunderstood the law that under 1129, you can cram down on a secured party if you give them reasonable payments over a period of time and they retain sufficient collateral, not all of their collateral, but just sufficient collateral in order to cover the allowed amount of their secured claim.
Why wasn't there an objection to the doomsday provision at the time of the February 15th hearing?
Judge, that whole conversation started out with, we did our presentation, then the judge started going into, well, what about this, what about that? And I said, and I told the judge, as I pointed out in my brief, Judge, what we need to do is, I mean, there's a number of things that have to be done. We're looking at financing for the development, we're looking at selling some assets. These things don't happen overnight, and I can't promise I can do them. I mean, they all make sense that I should be able to do them. So I said to the judge, come back in a status conference, a month, 2 months, let me tell you where we are. And at that point in time, the judge, as I'm sure you've read the record, said, we're past that, I don't even consider that. So what he's telling me is either he's going to shoot my client then, or he's going to give us a running start, and then, in my opinion, shoot us about, 100 yards down the road. And of course, I'm going to tell my client, run down the road 100 yards, and maybe he'll miss. But I apologize for that, but it's almost that start. And Your Honor, when the judge is telling me, basically, you have no choice. Because if you don't treat this, and it all comes down to, if you don't treat this secured party the way I want you to, you don't pay them off in full, regardless of what the bankruptcy court says, or the bankruptcy code says, this plan isn't going to fly. See, there wasn't a choice there. I did the best I could to get as much as I could to my client. Yeah, the judge, we went back in a room, and we talked about some of the terms. I came out to the court, and I said, you might as well shoot my guy now, because if you're going to impose some of these terms, there's just no way they're going to happen. And I know that's a big point. I hope I've answered your question. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkman. Mr. Asbach?
Good morning. David Asbach, appearing on behalf of the U.S. trustee. There are two main points I'd like to make in this argument. The first point is that there were ample grounds
to... We need to discuss appellate jurisdiction with you, too.
Of course.
Is there any?
Your Honor, there are two cases that I'm aware of where the court has addressed motions to convert or dismiss under Section 1112B of the Bankruptcy Code. One of those is the Woodbrook case that has been brought up already. The other one is the
There was no conversion in Woodbrook. If you read it, it has to do with a failed plan followed by an outright dismissal of the bankruptcy proceeding, which is, of course, as final an order as one can get.
Correct, and I agree with that. I think the section that we're talking about in this case is Section 1112, which has the alternative relief provisions in there, either conversion or dismissal. And that
conversion continues the case, and dismissal ends it.
I will say that
it's like saying a grant of summary judgment ends the case, and a denial of summary judgment continues it. The fact that you can appeal from a grant of summary judgment doesn't imply that you can appeal from a denial.
I think the cases, and I don't have a case to cite to you, I'll say that right off the bat, but I do think the cases on the final order in a bankruptcy context take the position that it's a more elastic concept in bankruptcy.
Yes, we've said that adversary actions which involve or would, outside of bankruptcy, be standalone pieces of litigation can be appealed. This is not an adversary action. This is a core proceeding. Right.
It also, though, the effect of this order effectively removes the debtor from possession. So from the standpoint of having long-lasting effect...
Suppose we have a Chapter 11 where the debtor wants to be debtor in possession and the bankruptcy judge removes the debtor in possession and appoints a trustee. Is that an appealable order? I think the answer is no.
I'm not aware of the answer to that question, Your Honor. But I think in this situation, the issue from the standpoint of the effect on the debtor, I have not challenged the jurisdiction of this court in my brief.
But it is not the lawyer's job to challenge or not challenge appellate jurisdiction. It is the lawyer's job to determine whether there is jurisdiction, as it is ours, whether the lawyers do their jobs or not.
Yes, sir. Well, the two points that I wanted to make during this argument were that there was abundant cause for the court to enter the order to convert this case to Chapter 7, not only as of the trial on February 14th and 15th, but also as of the order date of May 13th. That was the date the case actually was converted. And I see my time is up. I would close in saying that in the Woodbrook decision, this court did say that the bankruptcy court under Section 1112B has the discretion to say when enough is enough. And I would ask the court not to weaken that prospect.
I know you've pointed out that Mr. Malmgren himself proposed the timelines for the February 15th order and agree to a doomsday provision. But realistically speaking, what kind of choice did he have? I mean, the bankruptcy court made it clear to him that had he rejected the quick timelines or the doomsday provision, the court would have immediately converted the case to a Chapter 7. Now, that's not much of a choice, is it?
I think in the context of this case, where he had already violated the October 31 order, which had laid out a timetable for financing and filing an amended plan, what the court was essentially doing as of the February 15th ruling was giving Mr. Malmgren another chance, saying, you've violated it in the past, I'm going to give you one more chance, and if you violate this one, I'm going to convert you. And I would note that even though we've been talking about a doomsday order, the court didn't really convert it right after the affidavits of default were filed. There was another evidentiary hearing in which Mr. Malmgren had the opportunity to present more evidence and a confirmable plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Good to see you there.
David Caesar, appearing on behalf of St. Francis Bank, one of the banks involved in the case. There were two banks. We were the bank with the second priority lien position, so we had the most at risk given the collateral arrangement. I would only add a few extra points here. I would emphasize that it was the debtor who proposed those timelines and those things that he was going to do. While they were tight, and I recognize that counsel who's here today came into the case late, the case had been going on for a year already, and there were many missed deadlines, all of which supported the discretion that the court exercised in fashioning the remedy that it did, which included the drop dead provisions. I believe it is a discretionary call by the bankruptcy court, and the district court amply noted the missed deadlines, which supported the court's discretionary use. I don't think that the debtor could have said, no, I'll accept the ruling, and I'll go decide what to do after that, either appeal that or live with it or deal with it in some other way. While the court may have issued an order which was had close deadlines on it, or relatively close deadlines, they were proposed by the debtor, and that's why I think the debtor is bound by them. With respect to one other argument that the debtor makes, he argues that he was on the verge of confirmation, and he argues it several times repeatedly in the case, and I don't think that that's a fair statement of where the case was at that point, at the point that the debtor made that argument. He wasn't on the financing that had been obtained for the development was contingent on a $1 million appraisal of the development parcel. There was, as noted in the brief, an issue as to the conformability of the plan and even as to what standard we were going to be under 1129, whether 1129 B21 or 3. There was liquidation values that would have been contested and even feasibility. The bankruptcy judge recognized all that in one of the decisions that he issued, and therefore, while the debtor argues that he was on the verge of confirmation of a plan, that I don't think is fair to say that that's where it was on that date when the conversion order was entered, and I think the court exercised its discretion really before it issued the decision. And not necessarily when it issued the decision, but before it issued the decision, it said we're far past just another scheduling conference further down the road because of everything that had gone on before, including the fact that the debtor's first attorney in this case had brought a motion to be allowed to withdraw from the case because the debtor was not complying with court orders. That in itself would be sufficient, I think, for the court's exercise of its discretion to impose the drop-dead order, and I think that drop-dead order is justified, as the district court noted, under the discretion given judge in Section 1112B of the Bankruptcy Code, as well as under Code Section 105 and the two cases cited in our brief. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Mr. Cookman?
Thank you, Your Honor. As I said, this case is tough because it involves a lot for Mr. Mongren. It's also tough because I was on the verge of confirming this case. We had money coming into the estate that we didn't have 6 months earlier. There were a lot of things falling into place.
What was the difficulty in getting the evaluation of the property?
That wasn't a problem at all, because what it was we had the finance commitment that said, if you do these things, get a confirmed plan, get a valuation that says it's worth $1 million. We had a several-year-old appraisal done by Mr. Caesar's client that showed that the raw land, 16 acres of raw wooded land overlooking Green Bay, the water, was worth $250,000. What we also had was the fact that we knew when this was subdivided into 12 lots or whatever, that these lots up there were worth around whatever the number was. You know, I think it was $100,000 or $80,000, between $80,000 and $125,000. So in our minds, once roads are put in, you've got developed land, now you have subdivided raw land into lots. What's the big deal? I mean, we're going to come up with $1 million appraisal. That was not a sticking point. That had nothing to do with, I think, the bankruptcy court's decision. And I think the bankruptcy court, if you look in the April 26th transcript, what you're going to see is, and Judge Eisenberg, you know, said this when he was going through the case. He said to the other party, the bank, he says, well, don't we really just have financing by the bank itself? Don't we have self-financing, which I submit to you happens in a majority of the bankruptcy cases? We've got, you know, the debtor simply proposes a payment plan with a secured party, because not many lenders are willing to jump into the morass of a Chapter 11 case. So it's not that unusual to have self-financing, especially in this case when we have an operating entity. We have a little lodge that's spinning off, a nice little cash flow, that had enough sufficient cash to service that debt. And when I talked with when I was in court in front of Judge Eisenberg, in my heart of hearts, I believed we could get financing, outside financing. I knew from the way he was going that he wanted to see this bank, Bay Lake Bank, who's not here today, who hasn't argued a thing on this appeal and has the most at stake, because that's what we're all arguing about. They're not here. But anyway, that's what he was, all his indications were, you've got to come up with a way to get them out of here or this case is going nowhere. And in my heart of hearts, I thought we could do that because we do have a cash flow. I mean, this is a business that has been around for decades. So we've got an established stream of cash. We've got valuable property. We should have been able to refinance, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen in the 2 months' time. In order to do the other linchpin really was the development. And that, if we didn't have the financing, I probably wouldn't be arguing before you today, because there was no way a plan was going to proceed without some financing to do some development and turn this $250,000 of property into $1 million of property. But we did get the financing. Now, yeah, he should have gotten it. He should have gotten it when the judge ordered him to get it back in January. He should have gotten it then. But it took longer, and we did get it 2 months later. And I just feel like I had so many pieces in line ready to fall into place, and I had the easiest piece to deal with, which is, under the bankruptcy code, pay the secured creditor a reasonable amount over a reasonable period of time at a reasonable interest rate, let them maintain security in order to fully secure them, and that didn't, and all of a sudden, the game was stopped. It was stopped because the judge upheld his doomsday order, which says you must treat the bank in such and such a way. And I submit that none of the other cases that have been cited in the brief, none of them have ever had a doomsday order like that. And I think that it's a dangerous precedent for a bankruptcy judge to say you can't use a provision in the Chapter 11
court. Why isn't it even waived by agreeing to the order?
Judge, I don't think we didn't agree to the order. There was no, we will agree to this, don't give us your decision. The judge came back and gave us his decision. He was going back and forth with us. What will you take? Can I possibly do this? This was back and forth. He came back after lunch, and that's when he entered his order. This is the stick, this is the carrot and the stick. I respectfully request you reverse. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Kirkman. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under